This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at DOUCETSurvey.com. That's DoucetteSurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at NECU.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth-Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Like it or not, we are all liars. In fact, studies conclude that on average, human beings lie 2 to 3 times per each 10-minute conversation. And while we may be raised to believe that lying is wrong, Clancy Martin argues that it can be very useful, especially when it comes to love. Clancy is a novelist and professor of philosophy at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, where he teaches courses on deception and self-knowledge. His new book is called Love and Lies, and it was published this month. Clancy Martin, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me, Virginia.
So it's pretty clear, we are all liars, which you say is okay. Do we even realize when we're lying? Is it always conscious?
The answer to that question is, by far the majority of the time, no, we don't realize when we're lying. We're very good at deceiving ourselves before we lie to other people. There's a great cover of The Economist that came out during the fervor over weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and it showed Bush and Blair arm in arm, and the headline read, "Sincere Deceivers." And the point they were making there is that it wasn't so much that Bush and Blair were lying to the public as it was that they had selectively attended to the facts that confirmed a belief that they both all really wanted to believe. That is, they lied to themselves, and then they could be perfectly sincere when they're selling what some people have called a lie to all of the rest of us. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing, is we're incredibly nimble self-deceivers. The second thing is that if you think about your own speech or you think about your own listening, you'll realize that most of the time you're talking, 90% of the time, we're only kind of half aware of what's coming out of our mouths. Just as when we're listening to other people, the vast majority of the time, we're only about half aware of what they're saying. And consequently, we wind up saying a lot of false things or telling lies that suit our particular interests without even knowing that we're doing it. And this is what happens in these studies when people are shocked to learn, you know, they'll put a couple strangers in a room for 10 minutes and they'll have a conversation. And they'll ask the people when they leave the room, did you tell any lies during the conversation? And both people, almost without exception, will say, no, of course not. I didn't lie once. And it's when, after they review the tapes, that they realize, oops, sorry, that was a lie. And then a couple minutes later, oh, there was another one. And then a few minutes after that, oh, my gosh, I can't believe it. There's another one. And it's because we just simply aren't aware of the things that we're saying. We don't pay attention.
Well, before you reel back to the other part of the question, I'd love to, you know, pick up some of the things that you just mentioned. One, the lie that Bush and Blair were accused of, that is a huge accusation, a huge lie, you know, one that plunged countries into war. The other might be, you know, something we do in conversation or, you know, no, I've never taken a Post-it from work, you know. So,
right.
So there are degrees of deception. What are these degrees in your mind? Are some of them innocent lies and some of them not so innocent lies?
Yes, this is the single most important thing we can recognize about being skillful and caring when it comes to our speech. Honesty and dishonesty, truth and falsehood, they're not on-off switches. It's never the case that you should always tell the truth, and it's also certainly never the case that you should always lie. A lot of the times, a relatively innocent lie is called for. The most common of these kinds of lies are lies of politeness. Someone asks you, how are you feeling today? And actually you're feeling kind of miserable because you just had a big fight with your spouse, but you say, oh, I'm having a great day. How are you doing? You know, and it's just the kind of social grease that keeps the wheels of ordinary conversation and ordinary social interaction in motion. But there are many, many cases when telling the truth or telling a lie is a matter of incredible significance. That fact of the degrees of difference forces us to really think about what kind of a situation are we in. Are we in a situation where we really, it's best for someone we love, say, to tell them the truth, like, okay, you know what, I really think you've made a bad career choice here. I think that you need to try doing something else, and that's why you're so frustrated and so unhappy, and not to continue to enable the person in a bad choice. Sometimes, definitely, the truth is called for. Other times, it might be the case, like when you're reading the fourth draft of your husband's novel, and he's like, what do you think? I mean, I'm ready to give up. I don't think I can write at all. You might know him well enough, and the situation well enough to say, you know what, I understand how exhausted you are, and I know you must be totally frustrated with this thing, but I think you need to go back and try again and not give up. And that's the only way a lot of good novels get finished, is by somebody telling you something that is, they know to be false in a certain sense at the time, but they also know is necessary in order for you to get to the place you need to be.
Do we lie to the ones that we love more often?
Now, we don't have good statistics on this, except for in studies on children. It's been demonstrated that children are more likely to lie in situations where it is a person for whom they have some kind of relationship of affection, and or if they are worried about the person's feelings. So it looks like in loving contexts, children are more likely to lie. That said, I think that it's obvious that we are called upon more often to lie, to be nuanced speakers, to omit the truth or to manipulate the truth in various ways when it comes to the people we love. And again, the most obvious circumstances you can think of is if you are a parent of a child, or if you remember how, as a child, you dealt with your parents. Why did you tend to lie to your parents more often than you lied to other people in your life? Well, because you needed their love more, and you were more worried about losing their love, and it's as simple as that. Why do you lie to your children? And we all lie to our children an awful lot. And when we do, whether it's about Santa Claus, or whether life gets easier, or it's about death, or the many, many different reasons that we lie to our children, we don't do it because we have some cunning agenda about manipulating our children's beliefs. No, we do it because we love them. We do it because we think that we are in a better position to judge kind of what they need to know and when than they are. And this is the oldest defense of lying. It comes to us from Plato, and it's called the paternalistic defense of lying. And it also has a dark side, which is that when a government lies to the populace, the defense that the government almost always gives is that, well, the populace couldn't know the truth about X, Y, or Z because hysteria would have resulted, or, you know, we're just not smart enough to know the truth.
We're talking with Clancy Martin. He's a professor of philosophy and author of a new book called Love and Lies. It's an essay on truthfulness, deceit, and the growth and care of erotic love. Well, so you're talking about lying when something is at stake, obviously, either the
right.
love and affection of a parent or, you know, the opinion of the populace. But I'm very interested in what you had to say about lying within relationships. Normally, I would think of the untruth, the duplicitousness as something that would come as a relationship grows tired and void of passion.
Right.
But you're saying that it's in the very seeds, when even falling in love, that we're creating a kind of fiction. We're writing a lie on some level.
It's true. The process of falling in love is a process of fictionalization, of recognizing in some parts what your lover is, but then adding through your imagination and through the what you hear and what you choose to hear, and also more very much to the point, how you portray yourself. There's this great joke by Chris Rock, and he says, whenever you're first meeting someone, you're not meeting that person, you're meeting his agent.
Mm.
And I think falling in love is very much that way. I mean, when we're first seducing someone and being seduced, we're living in a kind of a very glorious world of our imagination. I think that when disenchantment starts to enter into a relationship, it's when we're sort of like, oh, well, all these wonderful fictions that we were kind of sharing together start to come apart, and now we're like dealing with, okay, this is the cold, hard truth of waking up at 1 a.m. to change the diapers and arguing about who did it last time. And so then the question is, do we find that we have to continue lying to each other in order to maintain long-term intimate relationships? And I think the answer is a kind of yes and no. It's very important, in my opinion, that between couples and married couples, that we have to think about what the truth is and what the needs are in terms of communication of the other member of the relationship. So that will mean sometimes omitting the truth, not saying what's on your mind. That will mean sometimes telling a lie. That, oh, yes, you look fantastic in that outfit. Or I'm so glad that you decided to get bangs. You know, those bangs look great on you. I mean, he or she is stuck with the bangs now. There's no point saying, you know what, oh, those bangs were a terrible mistake. Or perhaps even more fundamental lies, like when my present wife and I had a long conversation about this, and she said, well, you know, if I did have an affair, would you want me to tell you about it? And I said, no. And she said, well, why not? And I said, because our marriage matters more to me than my emotional fragility. Mm. Or maybe our marriage matters so much to me because of my emotional fragility. Mm. And I don't think I'm strong enough to be able to deal with the kind of jealousy I would be contending with if I knew that she'd had an affair with another man. And I would only want to know if it got to a point where it was threatening our relationship. And then I very much would want to know. But where does that place the burden? That places a lot of burden on her, upon like knowing what to say, when it's appropriate to tell me the truth, when it's not appropriate to tell me the truth. And the mistake we make, and I think this is the undoing of so many relationships that otherwise could have continued to grow and thrive, Virginia, is when someone has told a lie and then it's exposed as a lie, and then we draw the very unfortunate conclusion, oh, that means you're a liar and therefore I can never trust you
mm-hmm,
again.
Mm-hmm.
And everything you've told me has been a lie from start to finish, or from now on, everything that you tell me henceforth will come under suspicion because now you've revealed yourself to me as a liar. Well, that's a naive and really unhealthy way of understanding communication between loved ones and lovers.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because you mentioned your wife, your present wife. She's your third wife. You're very candid in the book. And you admit to lying to your past wives. You admit to deceiving customers as a jewelry salesman. And I can't help but think, as I'm listening to you, isn't that kind of convenient for you to couch lying in these kind of philosophical terms? It sounds a little bit like you're mounting a defense.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, no, I completely agree with you. I've asked myself the same question. Is all of this just an elaborate way of me trying to say, well, it's okay to lie because I happen to have told a lot of lies myself? We have this old myth in the West that is actually much less common in Eastern culture and Eastern philosophy, that there is some kind of strict identification between the truth and the good. Paul says it in 1 Corinthians, and the text that's so commonly quoted about love in the context of marriage. You know, he says, love does not seek evil, but seeks the truth. He's explicitly identifying truthfulness with goodness there. And I just don't think we really, in our ordinary human relationships, in the way we actually love each other, should operate with that kind of idea in mind. I think that that idea is a damaging idea, and that if we're going to be more grown-up lovers, we'll recognize that absolutely lies can be a really bad thing, but also absolutely truth and truthfulness and the demand for truthfulness can be a really bad thing. My own case might be an extreme one. That's entirely possible. But in my experience, it's not uncommon. In fact, just the opposite. Everyone I've ever talked to, if they're willing to talk to me at length, will come around to saying, I lied and I did it for reasons of love and et cetera, et cetera.
Well, Clancy Martin, it is a fascinating question and a fascinating book. Thank you very much for joining us.
I can't thank you enough for having me on, Virginia. It was a really rewarding conversation for me.
Clancy Martin is professor of philosophy at the University of Missouri in Kansas City and author of the book Love and Lies, an essay on truthfulness, deceit, and the growth and care of erotic love. You can find more on the book, including reviews, at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, more on the nature of lies and deceit. This time, there's money at stake in the constructed universe of game shows. Stick around for that when Word of Mouth continues after a short break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before the break, we heard from an author who says that lies and deceit are inherent in even the best of relationships. This next piece proposes that they are an essential ingredient in another institution, the game show. Caitlin Esch has the story.
In the old TV game show, To Tell the Truth, three contestants all pretend to be the same person. One is telling the truth, the other two are lying. Then a panel of celebrities quizzes the contestants and tries to figure out who's real.
And now let's meet our next team of challengers. What is your name, please?
My name is Peggy Larson.
My name is Peggy Larson.
My name is Peggy Larson.
The show aired for six decades. In this 1966 episode, two imposters and one honest woman claim to be Peggy Larson, a scientist who studies ants. The panel quizzes the contestants and tries to sniff out the imposters.
All right, number three, are ants communists?
Well, sometimes they're red, if that's what you mean.
No!
A normal person who lies is quite easy to detect.
Christina Bicchieri teaches psychology and philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania. She studies game theory and social norms, and she says game shows are the perfect microcosm to observe how people trust and how they deceive.
While if you lied to me, probably the color of your skin would change, maybe you would perspire a little bit, maybe you move the muscles of your face in a strange way, etc., etc. And I would be able to detect these subtle cues.
Bicchieri might be able to tell the liars from the truth tellers, but the celebrities couldn't. Only one guessed the right Peggy Larson. To Tell the Truth survived longer than almost any game show, in part because we like to test ourselves to see if we can spot a liar. Bicchieri points to studies where volunteers are shown pictures of people smiling.
And people say, oh, this is a fake smile, this is a real smile. I don't trust A, I trust B, exactly because people are very, very able. Think from an evolutionary viewpoint. We must be able to detect somewhat cheaters.
Today, we're still obsessed with programs that make games out of trust and betrayal.
This brings us to the moment that we have all been waiting for, where one decision could change a life forever.
In the show Take It All, players amass individual pots of money. By the end of the game, the two remaining contestants can decide privately whether to walk with only their pot of money or to try to take it all. If both decide to split the money, they each walk with their individual winnings. If both decide to take it all, they each walk with nothing. But if one decides to take it all and the other splits, the selfish contestant gets everything. You see how this can get heated.
But the interesting thing is that in the interaction with the other person, we get, unconsciously again, but very strong impressions about whether the person is trustworthy or not.
Let's take a listen to a clip from Take It All.
Go ahead. You're with each other.
Just off the top, I felt like as soon as I met you, that if I made it to the final round, I would hope it was you.
I felt the same way.
There's just something and I hate to cry right now, but there's just something genuine about you, and I hope that I'm reading you right.
You are. I felt the same way about you. There was a connection that we had together.
Okay, so this clip gives us a lot of information. Each player needs to decide how trustworthy the other is and whether they should share or be selfish.
All right, on the count of three. One. Two. Three. You, Anita, took it all. You have won a total of over $500,000, $554,300.
Christina Bicchieri has done trust experiments of her own, and she says that usually when two players are allowed to talk and make promises, they're less likely to screw each other over. Apparently, it's easier to cheat someone you've never met than it is to cheat your neighbor. Bicchieri also found participants were less likely to cheat if mirrors or even pictures of eyes were placed in front of them.
People may start perceiving that they are watched by somebody. And the mirror, you know, you look at yourself. And it's interesting, when people look at themselves, they seem to behave better.
And our thanks to producer Caitlin Esch for that story. Coming up, think love songs are sappy? Well, we're going to talk to an author who discovered a history that is anything but gooey and feeble. People have been punished and censored and even killed for performing love songs, even in America. The radical and disruptive love song when word of mouth continues.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The love song. Sappy, overly earnest in delivery, often adolescent in content, and sometimes downright schmaltzy.
It's very clear. Our love is here to stay.
That's Rosemary Clooney singing George Gershwin's classic, Our Love is Here to Stay. But here is another take.
It's very clear our love is here to stay. Not for a year, but ever.
That's Billie Holiday's version. A little more raw, a whole lot sassier. And a little bit of doubt is lurking behind her joy. And according to the music historian Ted Gioia, evidence of the radical, stop you in your tracks, disruptive nature of the love song. In a new book called Love Songs, The Hidden History, Gioia goes back through the ages and proposes that no other style of music has led to more censorship, controversy, or reprisals than the love song. And Ted Gioia, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So from the Greeks and Romans to the Song of Songs to medieval troubadours, Native American tribes, Miley Cyrus, people have been hearing and performing love songs. What are some of the common elements through the ages?
When I started working on this book, I would tell people I was writing a book on love songs, and they would give me a dismissive smile. They thought that this was wimpy music. It's soft. It's sentimental. There's not much happening there, and they thought the history of it would be pretty boring. But in fact, what I encountered in my research is that again and again, love songs created social turmoil, created unrest in the community, prohibition, censorship, excommunications, sometimes even executions. And at first this puzzled me. Why was this so? Why was this lovey-dovey music so controversial? But only gradually I realized that throughout history, the love song has been a vehicle for human rights, for individual freedom, for personal autonomy. People sang these songs to have more freedom over their life, especially their love lives. And they had to fight patriarchal institutions and church leaders and community leaders. So I discovered, much to my surprise, that this music, the history of which I thought would be soft and sentimental, was actually bloody and violent.
Hmm. And there's an evolutionary element that you found. The Chippewa Indians sang about divorce, as have the Maori of New Zealand. Medieval troubadours sang of unrequited love and sex, just like contemporary songs. So they lament, they charm, they seduce. And you argue that love songs actually fill a role in reproduction. It's sort of like our bird song.
Darwin believed that all music was a kind of love song. He believed that music was invented to help preserve the species. It was part of sexual selection. And he called a lot of attention to bird songs. He thought that the songs of human beings were like birds with their mating music. I've got to say that when I started my research, I was very skeptical of this. I thought there was such a huge leap between birds and people that Darwin was probably wrong. But you know, over the years of research, I became respectful of his view. I had a grudging acceptance of it, especially with a lot of recent research into biochemistry, which shows very strange linkages between the hormones correlated with sexual activity. They're also correlated with musical talent and interest in music. So I've come to the conclusion that Darwin was probably right.
Well,
all songs are love songs.
Let's also say, anecdotally, there's probably a lot of evidence that love songs may have been the first stage in reproduction.
Well, it always initiates the courtship. I like to say that if it wasn't for a love song, many of us wouldn't be there. If you look at our parents, there was probably some love song along the way that bonded them. And I know almost anybody you talk to and you ask about their personal relationships, their courtships, they will think back to the particular songs that were almost more than a soundtrack. They almost propelled the relationship forward. So yes, I think the first step in our relationships often comes from music.
Well, let's get to that subversive nature of the love song. Your subtitle is The Hidden History. Now, that's referring in part to those who have performed and composed love songs, many of them outside of polite, quote-unquote, society. Who?
It was surprising to me to see how often in the history of the love song that the people who got credit for the innovations weren't the people that actually did it. Usually you have some famous man whose name is associated with an innovation in love songs. So in ancient China, you have Confucius, who's given credit for the Xijing, the Book of Songs. But in fact, many of these are songs from a female perspective, so you know that Confucius couldn't have composed them. In our own tradition, in the Bible, the Song of Songs, you have these erotic love songs, again from a female perspective, and now they're attributed to King Solomon. Probably the most striking example are the medieval troubadours, these nobles of the south of France. They're given credit for inventing the modern love song, but what I found in my research is almost everything they came up with had been anticipated by women before. Women in Europe, and also these female slave singers in the Muslim world, that really created the modern love song. Mm. But the troubadours get all the credit.
You argue that the history of the love song is really the history of repression, but it's also a history of marginalized people, as we're hearing. You know, the Xijing was banned in the Confucian era. The music of African slaves and former slaves in the New World, they were allowed to play popular dance music in some cases, but not the love song. That was just a bridge too far?
It's amazing how the African population moved to the United States had such extraordinary influence on the love song, because originally they weren't allowed to sing those songs. If you went through the South in 1850, 1860, most of the musicians were blacks. I've got accounts of travelers that would say they would travel for hundreds of miles, and every musician they encountered was an African-American musician. But they weren't allowed to sing love songs. That was really not part of the accepted repertoire. Yet even in 1848, you have Stephen Foster doing O Susanna, which is based on African-American music, but it was a love song for white mainstream audiences, and it became the biggest selling song of its day. Hmm. And then at the end of the century, you have songs like Frankie and Johnny or Won't You Come Home, Bill Bailey. Once again, these were the most daring love songs in America at the time. They actually had these sexual hints that were very rare. And whenever they had a song with a sexual element, they would always put a picture of a black person or a white person in blackface on the cover of the sheet music. So clearly at a very early stage, the idea that these sexy love songs were out there was always connected in the public's mind with the black population.
Mm-hmm. So there was no overt expression of romantic longing for African Americans performing for white people. But of course, there was the tradition of the blues and jazz. Here is Bessie Smith showing some blatant sexuality in the song called Empty Bed Blues.
He's a with a strumpet kangaroo. He's a deep sea diver with a strumpet kangaroo. He can test the bottom and his wind.
These kind of erotic elements, they were just too much for the Chinese nobles, for the medieval nobles, and early 20th century white Americans, certainly. But you point to New Orleans jazz and blues at the turn of the 20th century as the biggest shift since the age of the troubadours. Now, what do you mean by that?
The blues changed everything. If you look at American mainstream music for the blues, it was boring. It was sentimental. People would sing about I love my home, I love my dog, I love my parents. But it was very banal music. In fact, if in the late 19th century you wanted to predict the future of popular music, you would have looked to Europe. You would have looked to the cabarets in Berlin or Paris. They were doing very exciting love songs, very spicy ones. They looked like they were going to surpass the United States. But then the blues emerged. And all of a sudden the blues changed everything. It dealt with these sexual issues with a frankness that no one had done before, but also with a kind of humor, a kind of poetry to it. So really, after the blues, not only did it change American music, but it allowed American music to flourish globally.
Think love songs are goopy and overly sentimental? We're talking with the music historian Ted Gioia, who has gone back through history and found that the love song has often been the most radical and disruptive and most controversial songs of their time. Well, you go further than that, that this transformation had an impact on the attitudes about love. In what way?
If you look at the 1920s and the 1930s, when blues and jazz took off, they actually changed the way Americans courted. All of a sudden, you no longer have references to parents in these music. The parents sort of disappear. You have a greater sense of personal autonomy, people seeking out their proper mate and looking for control over their own romantic life. And there were other things that were going on at the same time. Back in the 1920s and the 1930s, you had the first introduction of the car radio. Now, I think we tend to take this for granted nowadays, but think how that changed romance in the United States. First of all, just the invention of the car allowed people to have more control over their romantic lives than they ever had before. Finally, you could get away from parents. But also, now you had a soundtrack. You had romantic music on the radio. So I really think that the combination of technology and musical change not only impacted the soundtrack of our life, but how we lead it as well, how our romance is pursued.
So this story of, you know, Elvis Presley taking Big Mama Thornton's, you know, a black woman's song and taking it to the bank and to white Americans, that was replicating something that had been done over and over again in history. When was it acceptable for people to adopt the music of marginalized groups, and when wasn't it?
If you look at the connection between slaves and love songs, it's pretty much always there. I mean, obviously, we found that in the United States. We found that in the Muslim world in the medieval period with the female singing slaves who were innovative in love songs. Even if you go back to ancient Rome, most of their entertainers were slaves. The Romans thought it was disgraceful to sing music, and especially disgraceful to sing love songs. So again and again, we've looked to outsiders to teach us how to sing about love in new ways. And I think there's a very good reason for this, because when it gets to love life, when it gets to our sexual life, there's so many rules, there's so many regulations, there's taboos, there's expectations. And so we need someone that can break the rules and show us a new way of loving, and who better to do that than the outsider?
But really, is it the most censored or subversive music, more than ethnic folk music songs in Yugoslavia under communism, or protest songs, or racy blues songs, or early hip-hop, or hip-swiveling rock and roll?
I think if you look at the controversies of all those eras and all those songs, often the controversies are related to new ways of dealing with romance. If you look at why people were afraid of rock and roll, it was because of Elvis out there swiveling his hips and the sexual ideas it would raise. If you look at why people were fearful of hip-hop, well, just go look at the hip-hop videos with their sexualized content. So often we think the controversy is about the music, but actually the real controversy is how it influences the ways we love. Music has always frightened parents. It's always created revolutions. But the one interesting thing is love always does win in the end. It's like one of these Hollywood movies. Love always does win out. It changes the music, and it does change our love life.
Well, there's another part to the hidden nature of love songs that you talk about. It's our own ambivalence or even embarrassment about listening to these songs that are so smarmy but yet somehow get us. What's going on there?
There's no doubt that people are ashamed of these songs. As a music critic once said, 90% of the music out there is about love, but we prefer to talk about the other 10%. And I think that's very true. Where do we get this idea? I think we get it from the Romans. The ancient Romans were very anxious. They were suspicious of romance. They thought that love was not something you courted. It was something that you avoided if at all possible. It was a kind of disease. And they knew about falling in love, but it wasn't something they looked forward to. So they had this deep-seated shame and embarrassment about love songs. Strange to say, I think we still have that in the current day. In a certain way, we're like the Roman gladiators. We find it unmanly. We find it embarrassing to listen to this sentimental music.
So if we go back to this idea that the love song is a belief, or let's say a hope of charming and seducing, you know, the bird song of human beings, is there a song in particular that you go to listen to, play to set the mood, shall we say?
When it comes to love songs, my personal preference is for the songs that seem real, that seem authentic, that seem true to heart. We all know that the music business is an industry. We know it's about dollars and cents. But when it comes to the love songs, we want something that's real. We want something that's true. A few days ago, Sam Smith won the Grammy Award. And when he got up there to accept it, he said, "I want to thank the person that broke my heart. Because of that, I've got 4 Grammys." And people laugh, but I think that's part of the reason why we find these songs appealing. Because we know it's a business, but behind it, there's real music and real heartache. Because of that, I like to go back to the singers who really express that real heartache. People like Billie Holiday, or people like Frank Sinatra, or, you know, the Torch singers, Edith Piaf. You know, I'm sort of old school in that way. I think that they really captured the ethos of love best in their songs.
Ted Gioia, a fascinating book, and thank you so much for your deep history. It's really made me think differently. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Ted Gioia, he's a music historian and author of 9 books on music, most recently Love Songs, The Hidden History. There's more, including some reviews and articles by Ted, at wordofmouthradio.org.
Guess it's true, I'm not good at a one-night stand. But I still need love, cause I'm just a man.
Coming up, an ode to the flip phone and other objects left behind that carry memories of love. We'll talk to the creator of an online museum devoted to your parents' things. That's when Word of Mouth continues.
Stay with me, cause you're all I need.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. A waffle iron, a Twin Tower snow globe, a pair of running socks. These are some of the objects left behind by a dead parent that have meaning for survivors. For writer Bob Morris, it was his father's cell phone with a Mexican hat dance ringtone. He also has one of his parents' chairs, a plate, and a matchbox. The seeds of an online collection called Museum of Your Parents that invites anyone to contribute a photo of and short essay about something that their parents left behind. Bob Morris is curator of the museum, and welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you, Virginia.
So tell me a little about your dad.
Okay, well, you know, I started Museum of Your Parents because when my dad died, I had this Nokia cell phone. It was probably from like the year 2004 or something. And it was this radioactive object that I don't know why I kept it. It was useless to me, but it just spoke to all of our funniest and most conflicted situations.
Mm-hmm.
He was an abuser of the cell phone. In my first book, I wrote a lot about it. But, you know, this is a guy who was so friendly that when I would come to visit him, he would call his friends and try to make me talk to them on the phone. Or sometimes I would, you know, be trying to visit him and my mom, who wasn't very well, giving them quality time, and he would pick up the phone and start organizing bridge games at the dinner table. And you know, what can I say? I mean, at the time, I would be very critical, and it would kind of ruin my visit. And, yes, it had a Mexican hat dance ringtone, which I call the only politically incorrect ringtone I've ever heard. And so, like, this thing was loaded. And there it was in, you know, his apartment when he passed away. Suddenly, you know, our world, our relationship with him had been silenced. My mother had already died. I had no parents left. And I don't know why my hands went and seized this particular thing to keep. You know, I threw out most of his stuff. He was a complete, you know, rat pack.
Mm-hmm.
He was a hilarious, wonderful, impossible father. I don't know. He kept, like, cups of pills next to his driver's seat. You know, he had x-rays in the trunk. So of all the things that were so happily going into the dumpster, I kept the cell phone.
Well, you know, it's funny. Okay, so then from there, you decide to memorialize this cell phone in some kind of way.
Yes. I thought about what can I do to keep this, not just in my life, but in my mind and in my heart. And so I started this little website called Museum of Your Parents. I built it myself. It's very modest, but, you know, very quickly I started to get contributions from other people after I wrote about the cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
Originally, I was going to call the site My Dad's Damn Cell Phone. But I quickly realized that even though, you know, I've got another book coming out about the death of my parents in June, that I wanted other people to be able to talk about this. It's a, you know, the death of parents and ailing parents is a huge thing for us demographically. Many of us are going through with it. And at the same time, it's hard to find sometimes the lightness in it and also the sweetness in it. And there is sweetness in the passing away of parents. There's certainly sweetness when the aggravation of illness and weakness is gone, you know, and after you grieve, you want to remember.
Well, the thing is that I found interesting, you know, the kitchen appliance, the, you know, the little souvenir snow globe, not the things that you traditionally think of. It's not the family silver or the wedding photos or the trophies. Do you think there's been a shift, Bob, in what we find meaningful?
Oh, I definitely do. I mean, certainly, I think our generation is more ironic, for lack of a better term, and I think we're more design-oriented, and I think we're also, we have a greater sense of irony. There's actually another site that came and went, but I think was made into a book where people were really photographing the silliest, most heinous objects in their parents' homes as a way of making fun of them. And so I do think that humor comes into it much more, and I'm sure people do keep their silver. I have my parents' silver. I have their dining room chairs. But I also think that, you know, we are very, because we're so specific and design-oriented, we maybe don't keep the old traditional things. I don't know if that answers your question.
It does. I'm confronting this right now. Actually, I lost my dad 3 months ago, so thank you. It still feels very, very fresh to me, and we're going through my parents' boxes in their home, and besides discovering things that I left there many years ago, which is my own kind of museum, the things that I have found meaningful are the things that he kept for some reason. Like, I found this little billfold that he bought in Khartoum, Sudan. He was stationed in North Africa in World War II. And he wrote a little note about it, like, I purchased this while on R&R from Liberia.
Oh,
yeah, it is beautiful. But, you know, you think about how objects define a person in your mind, and then there are these little secret objects. You know, there are these little parts of them that get revealed.
I think for me, it's really, this is about the past that you knew so well and too well. And I think my whole goal really is to help people turn a corner in the relationship with their parents, not just to memorialize. Like, I encourage people to send in a loaded object like my cell phone,
mm-hmm.
something that speaks of the conflict, and maybe when a parent is gone, is now doesn't seem so necessary to be so, you know, at loggerheads with this person who brought you up and raised you, you know. And so the other day I was looking at this poem. Do you know Billy Collins' work?
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, it's this very short poem. I don't know if you care, but it's basically, It's about him driving past the cemetery where his parents were buried and being so busy that all he could do was honk the horn and wave as he drove past. And I think of that all the time. You know, I don't want to forget my parents. It's been 10 years since my dad died. You know, yes, I have another book coming out about that and really about what it's like to be there when the life leaves their bodies. But, you know, these objects keep them alive as much as photographs. Mm.
Bob Morris, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Sure.
Bob Morris is a frequent contributor to The New York Times and author of the upcoming book, Bobby Wonderful, which will be out in June. You'll find a link to the Museum of Your Parents at wordofmouthradio.org, and your submissions are encouraged. Thanks so much for your listening time today. There is much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any of today's show, you can catch it in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also search on Word of Mouth and NHPR on iTunes. And if you like the podcast, tell a friend. After all the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
With help from our interns,
Fiona Shea and Katie McAuliffe. The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.